Coop Up City Blues is Cuban-born writer Pablo Medina's fourth novel. It's set in a city very much like New York and begins with the story of a boy who's nearly blind and who was brought from Havana by his parents when he was 12. His parents are ailing, and in order to keep them from dying, he tells them stories. The characters he invents take on lives of their own and exist side by side with historical figures like musicians Chano Pozo and Jelly Roll Morton. The result is a kaleidoscopic depiction of life in exile. It's published by Grove Press. I'm delighted it has brought Mr. Medina to our studio today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
This is a kind of a Scheherazade approach.
It's a little bit. It's a reverse Scheherazade in the sense that he's trying to keep his parents alive rather than himself.
Like the boy storyteller, you came from Cuba at the age of 12.
Right.
Your family came here in 1960, a year after the fall of Batista?
Yes, a year, almost 2 years after.
Were you well-to-do? Is that the reason you were leaving Castro?
We were middle class, not political at all. We had a small house. It was a matter of not wanting to lead the kind of life that was prevalent at the time. So we came to New York.
How much is the boy character based on your experiences as a newcomer in America?
Well, to some degree, everything you write is based on your own experiences. But he certainly, to some degree, the sense of enclosure, the sense of being inside and afraid to go out into the world, that's very much part of my experience when I was 12 and 13 and so on.
Although I assume you weren't as nearsighted as he is.
Not nearly.
He is seriously nearsighted. Although he can barely see, he is able to read and he devours everything he can.
Exactly.
Not just American books, Moby Dick, Huckleberry Finn, the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but also graphic novels about Mexican wrestlers.
Yeah. There's a little hidden reference there. The 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica is the one that Borges read.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, and he also had sight problems.
Right, correct.
Is there a reference to Borges?
Well, there's a reference to all of the blind storytellers throughout history, going back to Homer, mm-hmm. and Milton, and of course Borges.
Should I assume that you were a big reader when you were growing up?
Very much so. I started young, and it was one of the things that I entertained myself with, and I kept going.
Is that a way of understanding the world beyond one's immediate circumstances, especially for an immigrant child?
Absolutely. When we got here, one of my best places was the New York Public Library. On cold days, I couldn't go outside, so I would go straight to the library and spend hours reading and looking at magazines and looking at papers and so on.
The boy's nanny, Cornelia, is also his father's mistress. She's a former philosophy professor, a really ruthless chess player, and also living in exile. Where did she come from?
She comes from Hungary, and hers is an interesting story because she was in exile from Hungary after the Soviets and made her way accidentally to Havana, and there was able to get a job as a university professor. But then, of course, after the revolution, she comes to this country and finds herself as a nanny to this blind storyteller.
Cuba had been very generous to people who were escaping the various problems of Europe.
Yes.
They couldn't get into the United States often, but they could get into Cuba. And then it was easier for them to get into the United States.
It was very easy. It was an easy jumping place, although many of them stayed, surprisingly. And Havana was certainly very cosmopolitan in that sense. There were many Europeans. There were many, many European Jews, mostly from Poland, but also from Czechoslovakia and so on and so forth. So it did have that sense of an international place.
Now, Cornelia gives the boy pointers on storytelling over a game of chess.
Yes.
Is it important that she's from Eastern Europe?
It's important in the sense that she brings him a worldview that he may not have had he not encountered her. She's a very European person in the sense that she's very cosmopolitan. She knows several languages. She plays chess. She's a terrific chess player, and as was my grandmother. And that gives him something to hold on to beyond the immediate circumstances he's in.
Well, Well, you came here when you were 12.
12.
That's the cusp for learning to speak another language without an accent.
Right.
But I'm assuming that you do all your writing in English, although you have done translation.
I've done translations, but I also write in Spanish. I write poetry in Spanish. I'm just finishing, as a matter of fact, I'm finishing a collection of poems in Spanish.
And what does Spanish allow you to do in poetry that English doesn't?
It allows me to be more philosophical and range over abstract concepts that English is not quite capable, at least for me, capable to encompass.
You translated Poet in New York by
Garcia Lorca.
John Ashbery called your translation definitive. Lorca, of course, is Spanish, but and also, by the way, a victim of dictatorships.
Yes. And civil war. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Definitive, of course, John Ashbery calls it definitive, but it's definitive only until the next translation comes along.
Well, that's the interesting thing about translation. But I would think that Spanish, being a language that is easier to learn than many, would be easier to translate as well.
In some ways, but Poet in New York is a very difficult book. I was lucky to work with a New York poet, Mark Stantman, and the two of us collaborated on translating this Spanish, which is a very particular brand of Spanish, Lorcaese, if you will, into a particular kind of English which resembled it.
Some of your imagery in this book sounds like Lorca's graphic descriptions of the city.
Well, once you read Lorca, you can never get away from him, particularly the way he described New York.
But you don't. But you don't call the city New York.
No, I called it Cubop City because I wanted the musical illusion. Cubop City is a tune written by Mario Bauzá, who is Machito's brother-in-law, back in 1948.
He played with Dizzy Gillespie.
He played with Dizzy Gillespie and also with Chano Pozzo. And so Cubop was a type of music that blended Afro-Cuban music and bebop. And so it was one of the precursors of Latin jazz. So I immediately went to that as a very rich time in music and also a very rich time in New York, and picked up on it and decided that this book should be titled Cubop City Blues.
Well, this is all stories that this boy is telling, but then we have other stories, including the one about Chano Pozzo, mm-hmm. and something that happened in a Harlem bar. And
yes.
That's history, isn't it?
That is history. Chano Pozzo was shot in outside of a bar in Harlem by a drug dealer. Over a drug deal gone bad.
Terrible loss because he was probably the greatest conga player that ever lived.
Greatest conga player and a great composer too. We're talking about Manteca. We're talking, and there are a number of compositions he wrote that became jazz standards.
And then, so he was shot and killed. He died very young then.
Yeah, he died very young. Very young. Just as he was making it in the world of music in New York.
Then you have Jelly Roll Morton stealing the idea for the Spanish tinge from a Cuban cornet player.
Right.
Now, Jelly Roll Morton loved to stick little, I forgot what the dance is, but it's like a rumba into his variations when he was
right, and
doing
it's based on the habanera and the cinquillo from the danzón. They're all related, and that's what he himself called the Spanish tinge. And so I have this character who comes to New Orleans at that time and meets up with Jelly Roll.
So that would predate Afro-Cuban music.
Oh, yes.
So do Cuban musicians feel that they have been one of the sources of jazz?
I believe so. And it's not just Cuban musicians, but a number of musicologists think that there is a little bit of influence through New Orleans as far as jazz is concerned, that came directly from Cuban music.
Now, the book, I guess to some of it could be called magical realism, but you keep on changing genres here.
Well, I wanted, since I'm a poet, I'm also a nonfiction writer, I wanted to blend fiction, poetry, and nonfiction. I was interested in how prose and poetry meet. And that's been my concern lately as a writer. And it's something that I tried to work with, the raw material of the book.
And then you write in first person, second person, third person.
Yeah, the first person, of course, is the storyteller. Third person are all the other characters that make their way to the book. The second person is the mystery. And I'll leave it as a mystery.
Second person is you enter a room and
yes,
you see a writer sitting at the bar.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's a mystery because...
It's a mystery because, I'll reveal a mystery. That's really the author making his way into the writing.
So you have this boy inventing these characters. Some of them, we're not sure whether they're totally invented or
right.
whether they are real people that he's writing about. And then you tell historic stories. I mentioned
yes.
John Opozo, Shelley Roe Morton. There's a classic Cuban exile tale of a man and a small boy making it to Florida on a boat. In your version, they miss Miami and land near a group of nudists instead.
Right, right. And there is actually, north of Miami, there is a nudist beach called Haulover Beach. So they land a few miles north and are surrounded by nudists.
And then you write about Meyer Lansky. Hey, have you been back to Cuba?
I was back in 1999 for a brief 10-day visit.
Had you many memories? After all, you were 12 years old, which
yes.
is old enough to retain
all sorts of memories. I had many memories. They sort of shaped who I am. And when I went back, it was interesting that I could make my way around Havana without any problem whatsoever. I remembered all the streets and all the buildings and so on. So what I was looking at was the ruins of my memories.
Now, we learn on the first page that the boy's mother did not want him. Why is that important? Is telling stories a way for him to try to transform unbearable emotions?
Yes, of course. This is the one wound that he carries with him. And the idea of being wounded is something that runs throughout the book. From his own wound that his mother didn't want him and tried to abort him, and that's the reason he's blind, to this other character in the book, Angel, who is knifed mysteriously on a city street.
At one point, you compare storytelling to trying to catch the big fish.
Yes.
I wasn't sure whether you were referring to Hemingway and the Cuban connection or to Melville and the Moby Dick connection.
Both. As I was finishing this book, I was rereading Moby Dick, and of course that made its way into the book.
Now, I've always wondered why there have probably been more books about Cuba and Cuban emigres than any other emigre community. And about two-thirds of them are about how we're going to go back after Castro falls, and one-third is it doesn't matter. It's going to be a different country. We can't go back. We're Americans now.
Right. The truth is somewhere in between. Nobody knows what's going to happen. There's always a longing to return, but there's always the reality of not returning.
But do you think that people from other countries, Hungarians, Romanians, people from Africa or wherever who felt that Chileans who felt they were forced into exile at one point or another, did they have such strong connections to the country they left?
I do believe, and whole literatures have been built around that. I need only mention Nabokov and his own sense of nostalgia that made its way into his writing.
Although he did best when he wrote in English in America.
This is true.
Pablo Medina's new book, a novel that's kind of like short stories and plays all sorts of games with
It's a
genres.
Novel, Leonard. I'll push the idea of the novel.
It's called Cubop City Blues, and it is published by Grove Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. A pleasure.